Lizer to introduce our main speaker tonight, Jay Depp, on the vocal.
How's everybody doing? All right. My name's Jaden. I'm an alcoholic. It's a pleasure to be here tonight. I regard speaking at an AA meeting to be, you know, a pleasure and an honor. And I really appreciate the invitation to come here and share tonight with you. I was about 6 months sober, and the first time I was asked to speak at an AA meeting, and I was a 10-minute speaker at a meeting in Arcadia. And I went to my sponsor, and I said, Pat, they've asked me to speak. What do I do? He said, well, be honest, don't try to impress, and for God's sake, be brief. Well, I know we're on a clock tonight, so I won't be as brief as I might be otherwise, but I'll try to do the other two as well as I can. I will also give you just one little caveat, and it's a fair warning to you and to me, and that is that when I do this, and I don't do it a lot, but when I do it, I get very grateful, and I get emotional when I speak. And some people get a little upset by that. I find it to be kind of embarrassing, but it happens, and, you know, we all just sort of move on. And I, you know, it is truly a matter of gratitude, because I've been at this for a while now, and, you know, my life is centered around, you know, the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I lead a sober and very sane life. And when I really stop and think about where my life could have been, it really gives me pause to reflect, you know, and it gives me just enormous gratitude for the life that I've been given. I started drinking very early on in life. The first time I remember getting drunk was I was in the sixth grade, and I had spent the night with a boyhood friend of mine whose parents were out of town and whose big brother was home. And, you know, and singularly in that night, we looked at Playboy magazine. The big brother bought us lime vodka and Coors beer, and we had a party. You know? And that in and of itself is not all that interesting, but what is interesting is that the next morning, the other guys I was with were all just sicker than hell. They had been throwing up all night, lime vodka. Who in the hell drinks that stuff, you know? And I was fine. You know, had a great time. I became a man that night. I drank alcohol, and I looked at Playboy magazine. Just doesn't get any better than that. You know, I'd like to tell you that started a trail of, desperation drinking, but I was in the sixth grade. I mean, how much trouble can you really get into, you know? But it did start, for me, the realization that, I could do that, drinking, and I could do it very well. And I could do it better than anybody I knew. Bar was pretty low, I mean, sixth and seventh graders, but, you know, but I really did it pretty well, you know. I also grew up in Salt Lake City, Utah, and I've thought about this a lot, and I really hope I don't, offend anybody. But you know, when I was that age, you know, you're into puberty and you're really looking to be accepted by everybody around you. I was an Episcopalian growing up in a Mormon community, and I was bodily and mentally different from my fellows, because all of my fellows were going to a different church, and they were going to a different Boy Scout troop, and they were doing things that I didn't do because I wasn't of that faith, you know. I also had a very violent alcoholic dad at home, and so that made me even more bodily and mentally different from my fellows. Because I knew that their home life was nothing like my home life, The speaker earlier talked about hiding alcohol around the house. That was one of my dad's favorite tricks. You know, he'd hide mixed drinks in the garage. You know, you'd find a glass that was full of ice cubes and bourbon. You say, "What's this?" And he just said, "Well, I don't know. I don't know where that came from." You know, if you grow up with that, you know, you get kind of a weird perception of what reality is and is not. You know, and you know, my dad was one of those guys that just, you know, he was just a hard-ass guy. He was a World War II veteran. He was a really smart guy, and he drank himself to death. So, you know, early on in my life, you know, I was just different than other people. But, you know, we'd go out, we'd steal, you know, alcohol or beer or whatever from our parents, and we'd drink, and, you know, it made me a man. And it made me a man every time I did it. And I liked it, and I enjoyed it, you know. You know, by the time I was in ninth grade, my friend and I had been drunk every Friday and Saturday night for 26 weeks. Now, I know that doesn't impress many people in this room, you know, but I'll tell you, when you're in ninth grade in Utah, in a society that doesn't condone drinking, that was a big deal. At least in my mind, it was a big deal, you know. I got an awful lot of self-esteem from drinking, you know, I really did. And I also got an awful lot of resentment against that Mormon church, because I couldn't understand why, you know, the parents of these girls that I try to, you know, to call or to date or to, you know, to visit with didn't want me around. You know, I thought there was something really wrong with me. You know, the fact that you have a 14-year-old kid show up on your doorstep drunk on a Tuesday night at 9:30, I tell you, you don't win a lot of favors with the parents, you know, and that's the kind of stuff that I would do, you know, and just carry that resentment. You know, those bastards, they just don't like me. They just don't like me. And that would give me more reason to drink. You know? My drinking career took a lot of, you know, sort of quantum leaps, you know, and, you know, one of the first quantum leaps in my drinking career was that, my friend and I found a wallet that had a draft card in it, and the draft card showed the guy being 22 years old, and the guy was a 5'10" black guy, and we took that draft card and we laminated it at Woolworths back in the day when they had Woolworths, and I was then able to use that draft card to buy beer, and it was just hysterical. I wasn't even old enough to drive a car, so we'd have to get somebody's older brother or sister to drive us down to the store. We'd go in with this draft card that clearly said black. People never looked at it. You know, we'd buy a couple of cases of the cheapest beer that we could find, pay for it, and then sell it to all of our friends for three times whatever the price was we paid. So it was a very entrepreneurial business. I was getting drunk. I was getting all my friends drunk, and I was making money getting drunk. It was great, you know. I mean, it really worked out. You know, I just kind of kept that kind of party thing up, you know, through high school. And, you know, we had all kinds of misadventures that, you know, that kids do, at least they did back then, you know. We had a number of times where the police would just take our beer, put it in the back of their car, and drive off, which really pissed you off, because then we'd have to go back to the store, get out the draft card, go buy more beer, and, you know, continue on our way. You know, I survived that high school experience pretty well, and I, you know, was accepted to college and went to college. And about that, that first year in college, my parents got divorced, you know, and broke up because of my dad's alcoholism. You know, this was a guy that was a research geologist and, you know, really a smart guy. And, you know, he got fired from that job and ended up living in a Skid Row hotel in Wyoming. But, you know, I went on to school and, was just drinking all the time. You know, I mean, it just became part of what I did and who I was. And it became a big part of my identity because I was doing it so much better than anybody I knew. You know, I had a lot of practice at it. You know, I came across sort of the second quantum leap in my drinking. I had, gotten all the way through college, and I, started, you know, my business career, and there was a bar that I frequented that my sister worked at that needed bartenders. And so I got a job tending bar one night a week. And in Utah, these bars were, there were private clubs. So every drink that you made had to have a mini bottle in it, and you know, you could only pour a certain amount of beers, and the rules, the liquor laws were all very confusing and that sort of thing. But you know, I started that job working one day a week, and that very quickly became the whole hub of my social life. Because the deal in this bar was, they didn't want you to be too drunk when you worked. They didn't mind if you drank when you worked, and they gave you all the beer you wanted, whether you were working or not, and drinks for 50 cents. So, you know, I mean, it was great. You know, I mean, it really was great, because you could just absolutely tie one on for $5, you know. And so, you know, at that price, I was doing that 5 and 6 nights a week. You know, that job ultimately over the next 3 or 4 years dwindled down to the point where I was working one day a month and yet getting these unbelievable benefits. And they finally had a guy come in and fired all of us part-time guys because we were killing them profit-wise, you know, drinking away everything that they had, you know. You know, I started my business career in Salt Lake City and, you know, started working with this company for a couple of years, and you know, it was really going pretty well. And through a couple of you know, promotions, and you know, a guy left the company. All of a sudden, I find myself managing an office for this company, and I had 8 or 9 people working for me. And they gave me another thing, which ultimately ended up being a quantum leap in my drinking career, and that was an expense account. And in my business, entertaining was a really important part of what I did. You know, it was expected that I would be out with my clients and customers, and that, you know, if we needed to go to a place where we could have a drink, we went to a locker club that I had a membership to. You know, they didn't, you know, there just wasn't any real regulation in terms of what you could spend. And so I took that expense account and just abused the hell out of it because I felt that I was due. I was due that money. Wrong idea. You know. So I'm working for this company, I'm using this expense account, I'm doing my thing, I'm bartending, you know, my life is really going into the shitter because I am drinking a lot. You know, I'm drinking 5 and 6 days a week. I'm able to get to work okay, and I'm working, you know, a full day and everything, but every night was in the bar, you know. And, you know, it was just clearly a lifestyle that, you know, was pretty limited, you know. I'd been doing that for 3 and 4 years, and I was in a bar on a Tuesday night. I can see it as clearly today as it was the night it happened. I'm sitting in a bar, it's Tuesday night, Salt Lake City, it's 11:30 at night, I'm with my best friend. We confide in each other that we're alcoholics, but it's okay, because we're having so much fun, you know. We're the only two people in this bar. But we're having so much fun being alcoholics that it's all right. Yeah. What a life, you know. I'm 27 years old, you know, I've got a college education, on paper a bright future, and I'm just pissing it away. You know, sitting in the bar with my friend, having a good time because we're celebrating that we're alcoholics. You know? So, you know, within the next year, you know, that lifestyle kind of caught up with me, you know. I was unable to have a relationship with anybody, particularly a woman, you know. You know, I was one of those guys that was probably a pretty good catch until the second date. Second date, they'd watch me knock down, you know, 9 or 10 bourbon and waters, and any girl with a half a brain would walk away from that, and they did, you know. So I decided that my problem was that I lived in Utah, and that had to change. And you know, this company I was working for had openings in Los Angeles, and they had openings in Houston, Texas. And I convinced them that my services would really be, you know, of, you know, benefit to them if they moved me to Texas. And so I did. You know, I went to Houston, Texas. I had an aunt and an uncle that lived there. This was my new master plan, you know. I'm going to go to Texas. I'm going to be with this aunt and uncle. It's going to be great. They've got all these social connections. My life's going to change. Everything's going to go forward. You know, I'm going to leave that drinking life behind me. I'm ready. I got drunk on the plane going to Houston. Got off the plane. It's Labor Day weekend. It's about 150 degrees in Houston, 150% humidity. I go out to get the car that's waiting for me at the airport. It's got two flat tires. Should have been an omen, you know, should have been an omen. As it were, you know, I got to the hotel and the drinking just continued, you know, it just continued. And by the way, that aunt and uncle, 3 days after I arrive in Houston, she backs a moving van up to the house, packs all her stuff and leaves because my uncle's an alcoholic too. All of a sudden that Houston, Texas thing just started to fade a little bit, you know? It just wasn't looking quite as sharp as I had hoped. But, you know, I decided to make the best of it, and I very quickly found a group of guys that I worked with. I was in a big office. I found a group of guys that I worked with. We were all about the same age. We were all single, and, you know, in the early 80s, there was an awful lot of money in the oil business in Houston, and they had these nightclubs that would start their happy hour at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and happy hour would go until about 8 or 9. And that became where we ate and where we drank and where we partied. You know, and it was like every night after work, we'd all, you know, get out of work at 4:30 or 5, go to these clubs and, you know, just party as long as we could, and then, you know, call it a night when the happy hour ended. You know? All along, I had been a blackout drinker. You know, it started when I was in high school. I always tried to control it, never did a very good job with it. But when I started drinking and drinking heavy, I never quite knew where I was going to end up, you know. And, you know, there used to be a TV show that starred Scott Bakula, and I don't remember the name of the TV show, but he would sort of, you know, appear into these historical situations and really not sure where he was and sort of have to adapt to what he was doing. And that's kind of the way my drinking was, you know, at that point. Because I'd come to in a car driving from Houston to San Antonio, and I'd be 120 miles out of town. And I had no idea in the world where I was going, why I was going, or what had happened to even get me there. And so I'd have to, you know, come to, turn around, drive the car back home. Houston was a city that kind of worked on a spoke thing. You know, you had the kind of the town or the city, and then this freeway that went around the outside of it, and you could go one way to Dallas, and you could go one way to San Antonio and Corpus Christi and, you know, all these different areas. And, you know, in complete blackouts, I found myself on every one of those roads, you know, at some point in time, you know. They had filmed the movie Urban Cowboy in Pasadena, Texas, which is a suburb of Houston. It's about 50 miles outside of Houston. I lived in Houston for a little over a year, tried to get to Pasadena, Texas. Every weekend I was there. Never made it. I'd start heading for Pasadena. I'd end up heading halfway to Dallas, you know. And it just, you know, it was really getting scary, you know, really getting scary because I was doing things with people that, you know, I was putting myself, you know, at great risk. I was putting anybody that was with me at great risk. And, you know, it just was a bad time, you know. I mean, it was a bad time. Texas didn't work out, you know. They had this law in Texas that was really interesting at the time. And I don't know if they still do or not. But, you know, when I was there, it was illegal to be drunk when you drove in Texas, but it wasn't illegal to drink and drive. So every club that you went into would give you one of those red, you know, traveler cups, and you could just take cocktails from place to place. And that never made any damn sense to me at all, because anybody that was leaving a club was half in the bag when they left and more in the bag by the time they got on the road, and that was always my experience, you know. You know, after a series of you know, misadventures in Texas, you know, I was able to convince that company that, you know, that job they had available for me in Los Angeles was probably a better fit, and that would really be the best thing for me. And so they moved me to Los Angeles. Got on that plane, firm resolve, never going to drink again. It's not going to happen. I'm going to leave that Texas stuff behind me. that alcohol stuff behind me, it's going to be a whole new chapter. I've got a 9 o'clock flight out of Houston to arrive in L.A. at noon. I got drunk on the plane. I arrived in Los Angeles, had no idea in the world where I was going, what I was doing. You know, what's new? You know, what's new? What I did know, that when I got to Los Angeles, I knew that my my driving addicts and my my blackout addicts weren't going to be able to work in a city like Los Angeles. It's too damn big, you know, too big, too intimidating. And so I decided that, you know, I was going to live real close to my work and real close to my bar. And I identified that the first day I was in Los Angeles, and as a result, I lived about 2 or 3 miles from my office. And on a pinch, I could walk home, or more than likely, I would drive my car in the gutter the 3 miles it took to get from that bar, you know, to my house. And that then became my world. In the meantime, my job's going pretty good, amazingly enough. You know, I'm getting all these promotions, and life is good, and, you know, it's just, it's, you know, for me, it was just alcoholism in your late 20s. You know, you're still strong enough and mentally alert enough to, you know, to dodge a lot of the arrows, but, you know, you always hear that drum beating and that drum beating up behind you, and you know that it's coming. You know, the end is near, and that's what I knew for me. When I was in Texas, they brought in a guy into our office, and this was kind of a revolutionary deal. And, you know, keep in mind, this is like 1982. And this guy worked for an employee assistance program that my company had just arranged to have available for all of us employees. And this guy spent an hour, the manager of the office brought everybody in the office, there's 40 or 50 people, and we're all in his office, and we're all there to listen to what this employee assistance guy had to say. And this guy, introduces himself, and he talks about an employee assistance program that you can call if you have a problem with drugs or alcohol. And they will very anonymously help you. They will direct you to treatment. They will help you do whatever you need to do, you know, to address your problem. And I was sitting in the back of that room, and I was dying because I knew I had that problem. I knew that that guy was talking to me and people like me. You know, and that meeting got over, and that manager said, "Well, is there anybody here that has a problem?" Waiting for the hands to shoot up. No hands shot up, and there he turns to the guy and goes, "Well, there you have it, Jim. Nobody's got a problem here." You know, luckily I had kept that guy's name and phone number. I had a problem. I had a big problem. And, you know, I would call that guy, you know, when that problem got to the point that I could no longer deal with it or no longer manage my drinking. And it wasn't too long after, you know. My social life was declining, you know, to say the least. My last drink came. I would, ask a woman out on a date. I will tell you that she was not the kind of girl that I would take home and introduce to my mom. You know, it was one of those dates that, she didn't feel good about it. I didn't feel good about it either. We both got absolutely pie-faced drunk. And I woke up the next morning into what looked like a crime scene in my house. And I had no idea what happened. But it scared me enough that I remembered that guy, Jim, and that phone number. You know, and I called him. And I said, this is what happened, and, you know, I'm scared, and I've really got a drinking problem, and I just can't seem to do anything about it. And I went through all of that stuff that many of us go through, you know, where you're very contrite, you know, very scared and all. And this will show you how quick this alcoholic mind works. He goes, "Well, do you think you have a problem that, would require hospitalization?" That quick. My mind said, "Oh, God, no, it's not that bad." You know, I was backpedaling in that sea of denial the second that guy opened his mouth. You know, and thank God he kept talking. You know, he just kept talking. I ended up spending about 2 or 3 hours on the phone with that guy. And we talked a lot, and the gist of that conversation was, "Why don't you try going to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous and see how that works?" and if there's anything else that we can do, you know, we will try to do. I figured I had really nothing to lose except for the fact that I had just gotten a promotion at work. I'm driving a brand new company car. I've got a big corner office in a building in Pasadena. You know, so I suit up and I go to a meeting at the 202 Club in Pasadena, Pasadena, California. And, you know, the 202 Club was a club that, you know, a lot of people that were kind of down and out went to. It was a club that, you know, a guy like me that shows up in a press shirt, shine on my shoes, slacks, I was conspicuous. You know, I just stood out, you know, because there weren't a lot of people that looked like me in there. You know, and they, again, that keen alcoholic mind of mine, you know, I get into that meeting, I sit down, I'm scared to death, I don't know what's going to go on. They pass the seventh tradition. I put $5 in the basket because I figured you guys needed some help. Egomaniac with inferiority complex kind of fits the bill, you think, you know? A guy was sitting next to me at that meeting and he said, do you have a big book? I said, no. He goes, here, take mine. And I did. That's what big book I use today. You know, I know what got me to that first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous because I knew I had to report back to this gym guy, you know. The mystery of Alcoholics Anonymous is what got me to the second meeting, because I went the next day. And then I went the next day, and then I went the next day, and then I went the next day, and I'd been going there for about a week or so. I'm feeling pretty good, you know. I'm looking around, it's a club, there's a lot of stuff going on. There's women at this club. I start talking to a couple of the women. I'm figuring, it's a club, it's got to be a social thing, this would be great. Thank God. The women of that club looked at me, knew I was a whippy newcomer, and wouldn't have a damn thing to do with me. Yeah. Why don't you go into the meeting and quit standing outside? Okay, you know. So I did, you know, and, you know, I got, I went in there in October, and, you know, it got to be toward the end of the month, and, you know, I really was having a good time. You know, I met this guy in the club who became a good friend of mine, you know, those good AA friends. You bond with them immediately, you know, we're just really tense and good friends. And, you know, he had a car that he had cut the roof off of the car. And the car was also his apartment. You know, he was living in his car, had this roof cut off of his car. And we're driving around Pasadena one day looking for a place to cash some check that he had. Now, I'm seeing myself as this executive in training with the shine shoes and the pressed shirt, and I'm driving around this guy with a cut-off lid or cut-off roof to his car, and I'm having the time of my life. I'm thinking, this is great, you know, because I finally found somebody that I can relate to, you know, that shared the problem and the disease that I had, you know. So we move on another week or two in that month, and, you know, again, you know, I'm going to these meetings, and it's all, you know, it's all good and everything, and I have a Halloween costume contest because, you know, Halloween's coming up. And, you know, so I go home, and I put on my best Harpo Marx costume, and I come back to the costume contest, you know. This is how naive I was. I get to this meeting, and most of the meeting are guys in leather jackets, and I thought they were all dressed up like the Hell's Angels. I thought, God, what a great group. I mean, these guys really have got these costumes down. I was like the only guy in costume. I ended up winning third place in the costume contest because the other two guys had better costumes than I did. You know, there was only about three of us that even had a costume on. You know. Yeah, I don't know. You know, it's that... It's I just kept going back. You know, I just kept going back because it felt so good. I was physically getting sober, and I was with people that I understood what they were talking about, and they understood what I was talking about. But I hadn't really started working the program or really working the steps, you know. And So I decided to branch out, and I went to a meeting on the other side of Pasadena. And, you know, that to me is where my recovery really began, because I went into that meeting, and there was a guy at that meeting that was, you know, this just very intense. He had those really intense blue eyes. You know, he was really kind of charismatic, and, you know, a lot of guys were talking to him, and, you know, he was obviously the guy, you know. And I hadn't had a sponsor at this point. I was really looking for a sponsor. And so I listened to this guy talk, and he really seemed to be walking the walk and talking the talk. And I went to a meeting, you know, the next night, and he was there. And the next night, and he was there, and I asked him to be my sponsor. And that really is one of those things that was a life changer, because, you know, this guy was more interested in saving my life than he was in being my friend. And that's the way he treated me. You know, and thank God for that, because guys like me, you know, I had you know, the denial and the resources to just kind of blow people off, but I couldn't do it with this guy. You know, I just couldn't. You know, I asked him to be my sponsor. He said, "Are you willing to go to any lengths to stay sober?" I knew the answer to that question, by the way, was yes. And so I answered, "Yes, I am. Go to any length to stay sober." I said, "Okay, here's the meetings you're going to." And he started lining out meetings that I would be attending over the course of the week. And it was one every night. Wait a minute. I'm an executive in training here. I got stuff to do. I'm important. He goes, "There's nothing more important than staying sober, you know. You said you'd go to any length to stay sober. This is what you have to do. And by the way, I'm going to be at all those meetings, except for the one on Thursday night. I don't go to that because I take my wife out that night." And sure as hell, every meeting I went to, this guy was there. Now, I know this is probably an exaggeration, but every conversation with this guy, whether it was right out of the gate or 10 seconds into the conversation, always came back to the same thing. What step are you on? Because I'd go to him and want to bitch about what a lousy day I had that day, or how somebody did me wrong, or traffic was terrible, or, you know, something was going on in politics, you know, he just looked at me and say, "What step are you on?" Well, I had to get into the steps. You know, I mean, there was just no way around it. You know, no way around doing that. And by the way, he was sponsoring about 14 other guys in the same group, you know, so we all started, you know, kind of doing the deal. And he treated everybody the same way. And so he really got me into the steps, you know, and I had been in this program for about 90 days. And I'll never forget, I was at home, you know, I was about ready to go out, because I didn't think it really applied, that I was a little smarter than this, you know, that my case was different. You don't understand, my case is different, I'm not like this. And I just went to my knees, and, you know, I prayed for God to come into my life, and he did. Right then, you know, and the room got kind of fuzzy, and I know that all sounds kind of new agey kind of stuff, but that's the way it happened for me, you know. And the desire to drink left me that day, and it's never returned. You know, I kept working the steps with that sponsor. I'd see him for dinner once a week before the meeting that I was going to with him that night. And we got, you know, we got to the point where, you know, it was time to do that fourth and fifth step. And I really was struggling with it, because I was looking for a really clear roadmap of how you do this. You know, you write this, you do this, you do this, you do this. And you know, I couldn't quite get from the big book how that was all supposed to happen, because that was the only source that this guy would use. You know, it's in the book. Well, what about, well, it's in the book. What about me? It's in the book. You know, and I kept looking at that big book, and I was thinking to myself, you know, there's got to be a better way. So I went to Vroman's bookstore in Pasadena, a big bookstore there in downtown Pasadena, and went to the Cliff Notes section. They had Cliff Notes for the Old Testament. You got to have Cliff Notes for the big book, too, you know. Look through the racks, nothing there. Ask the clerk, "Hey, do you have the big book Cliff Notes?" She looked at me like I'd completely lost my mind. What? You know, I went back and I explained to that sponsor. And he said, "You know, if you don't quit screwing around with this, you're going to get drunk. Start writing." And I got a pencil and paper and I started writing. And 2 or 3 days later, called that guy and came over. And we did the fifth step. You know, we were done with that. He hugged me, and he said, "I want to welcome you to Alcoholics Anonymous." And that was the gateway, you know, for me, because, you know, once with that, then we started outlining a program of now what are we going to do, you know, because there's a lot of amends here that need to be made. There's people here that have to be talked to. There's things that have to be done. And one of those amends was to that company, because I had been feeding off that expense account for a long time. And I explained that to my sponsor, and I said, you know, this ought to be on the amends list, but if I make this amends, I'm going to get fired from this job. He said, you know, he told me that you'd be willing to go to any lengths to stay sober. So whether you get fired or not, doesn't matter. This is one of the lengths that you have to go to stay sober. So I sat down, I made an appointment with my boss, and I sat down with him, and I explained to him that over the past number of years, I had been fudging that expense account and stealing money from the company and drinking it away. And he said, okay, quit doing it. I kept that job. Yeah. Then I had to go to that, you know, that family of mine. This is where it starts getting weird. It's pregnant pause with the water. So then I had to go to that family of mine and explain to them, you know, why I wasn't there and some of the things that I had done and you know, just the embarrassment of being who I was and what I had done and my motives for doing different things, you know. And those amends just, you know, I made that list, and we just started working through them. And, you know, just kept going. This guy had told me very early on in my sobriety, he said, you know, a guy like you should not be involved with anybody for at least a year. Do not date. Do not go out to coffee. Do not do anything. You need to just, you know, your number one priority has to be on your physical sobriety. I told him I'd be willing to go to any lengths to stay sober, so I said, okay, you know. So I get to the point where I've now worked the steps to the best of my ability. I've got a year's sobriety. I go to him and say, Pat, I've got that year's sobriety. What do I do now? He said, no, just do it all over again, you know. You know, thank God for that guy. Thank God for that guy. Because, you know, after about 18 months of staying sober, I met a woman in Alcoholics Anonymous that, you know, I developed a relationship. First woman I had ever gone on a date with that I wasn't drunk. First time. I'm 33 years old. I'd never been out with a woman that I wasn't drunk. October, we'll celebrate 25 years of marriage together. Yeah, it's a miracle. It really is. It's an absolute miracle that we've been able to do that. I've had a life today. I'm not sure how we're doing time-wise. About 10 minutes or so. I've had a life today that is, you know, I could never have possibly scripted the life that's been given me because of Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. My sobriety date is October 5th, 1985. So, in October, I'll celebrate 30 years of being sober, if I can stay sober that long, and 25 years of marriage, if I can stay married that long. And I think there's a pretty good chance at both of them, you know, I really do. I think there's a really good shot at doing both of those, you know. I've had unbelievable opportunities in this program to try and to fail and to try again, you know. I've had, you know, great people that I've come in contact with. I've had a couple of three just tremendous sponsors, and I've had some real duds. And that's just the way that the thing has worked, you know. This first guy was my sponsor for 5 or 6 years. Then he kind of trailed off. You know, I was kind of floundering around for a little bit. My second sponsor was one of the original guys at the Pacific Group in Santa Monica. Great guy, you know, unbelievable depth of knowledge, you know. that worked for a while, and then he, you know, went on to some other things. Since I've been up here, I've had the same sponsor who unfortunately passed away, you know, this past fall. And, you know, the sponsorship has been an absolute critical part of my sobriety. And it's been critical because the men that I have chosen to be sponsors don't want to be my friends. They want to be my sponsor. They want me to bring stuff to them that we can mutually solve through the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And thank God for that. You know, thank God for that. Because I am a hustler, I'm a bullshitter, and I will try to get away with whatever I can with the minimum amount of effort. Minimum amount of effort. And I have been fortunate enough to find people in my life that won't put up with that. They'll send me back to a step. They'll send me to a newcomer. They'll send me to a meeting. They'll send me a lot of different places. You know, and what I've kind of come to realize anymore is that the softer, easier way is to listen to their advice and just do what you're told. You know, and I'm not talking about just rolling over and, you know, but, you know, when you pick somebody that has, you know, more sober experience than you do, and you ask them a question and they tell you the answer to that question, you know, to me, there's an obligation to try to follow that and not try to second guess what that is. You know, and I've tried to operate that way my whole sobriety, and, you know, so far it's working pretty good. You know, pretty good. You know, I have a family today. You know, when I came in here, I didn't. I have a family that is by and large pretty united today. I have a great relationship with my daughters. I have a great relationship with my 7 grandkids. You know, I have people in my life that love and support me, and more importantly, that I love and support. Because, you know, I'm a self-centered guy, you know. I mean, it's part of the deal. It's part of the disease, you know. My first reaction to anything is, what's in this for me? You know. And what I find is that I'm not better off if there's nothing in it for me. That if I can give something to somebody else, that's the reward. You know, that is the reward. You know. That job that I had, you know, I stayed on that job for 25 years after I got sober. Part of my responsibility was to entertain people, entertain clients, take people out to dinner, spend money on them, wine them and dine them, the whole bit, you know. And the most fascinating thing about that, and I was thinking about this when I was driving down here, was that through that whole period, the only people that ever made a big deal out of me not drinking in a social situation were people that were just like me, that drank like me. That you'd put them into a social situation, they would be tethered to the bar. They'd never get more than 10 feet away from the bar because they wanted to know where that second, third, and fourth drink was coming from, and that's exactly the way that I drank. You know, I had been sober for 2 weeks, and I went on a business trip back east. And I was just dreading it. Oh my God, it was the worst possible situation, because in the past, these trips that I had been on, in my mind, were nothing but drunken debauchery at night. We'd buy all kinds of beer and liquor. We'd put them in the bathtub of the hotel. Everybody would drink, have a great time, blah, blah, blah. You know. So I'm thinking to myself, how in the world am I ever going to do this? I'm going to have to lock myself in my room. You know, I'm never going to get out of it. So we go, work ends. We go to the hotel room. Guy asked me if I want a drink. I said, no, thanks. I think I'll have a Coke. He pours me a Coke. That's it. All that drunken debauchery that I had in my mind was me. That's what I was doing in those meetings. Without me, the drunken debauchery wasn't going on. You know? Crazy. Really crazy. You know, I left that job, retired from that job 5 years ago. And, I've had a lot of things of the spiritual nature that have come into my life, and you know, as a direct result of this program. Because to me, once I found that higher power, you know, my mission is to continue to find that higher power and to continue to define what that higher power is and continue to try to incorporate that higher power into my life and the things that I do and the people that I interact with. And so 6 years ago, I started making flutes. Okay? Now, I know nothing about flutes. I know nothing about music. You know? I knew a little bit about doing woodworking, you know, and I just got called to make these flutes. What does that have to do with alcoholism? Not a damn thing. You know, it really doesn't. But it's a spiritual pursuit that kind of thing would never have been possible to me if I didn't have the open-mindedness to let that God or that higher power into my life, you know. And I believe today that higher power directs me in that and everything else I do. And for that, I'm grateful. How are we doing? Good? All right. Thank you very much.
All right.